Welcome to Tax Crime Junkies, the one-of-a-kind true crime podcast where the fascination with taxes meets the world of crime. Expert duo Dom and Tom combine their extensive tax knowledge with their love for unraveling crime stories. It's a deep dive into the most captivating tax-related crimes.
We'll explore shocking cases of embezzlement, fraud, money laundering, and more.
We'll speak to experts, lawyers, and yes, even to the criminals themselves.
But it's not just about the thrill of the crime. We're here to educate you on the importance of tax compliance, helping you steer clear of the IRS's watchful eye. Thanks for joining us on Tax Crime Junkies. Now, let the story begin.
Ever wonder what a major corporate fraud looks like from the inside? Pirate's Cove is a galloping crash course in how to spot one. Brought in to salvage part of the notorious South Lane Enterprise, Richard Bailey infuses a personal dimension into what otherwise might be an all-too-familiar smartest boys in the room tale. Not everyone can expose a $350 million fraud, but certified fraud examiner Richard Bailey not only did that, but he tells us about how, yes, an accountant can go undercover because he did, and he writes about it in a highly relatable, compelling, and enlightening way. And we have him back on today's show to wrap up the tale of the Southport Lane scandal. We'll talk about red flags and oversight, Richard's personal experience with uncovering and dealing with the ramifications of the scandal and the aftermath and all its legal consequences. Don't miss part two of our continuing saga, unraveling a financial prodigy's web of deceit.
In the summer of 2013, I get a FedEx package, and I get a call from Alexander Chatfield Burns's Jimmy Neutron's assistant, all right? And I am told that I need to sign the stock certificates and then put them in the accompanying overnight mail so that you overnight them back today.
It's owning the winery business, or which stock certificates were these?
Well, they created a preferred stock, which did not exist in the capital structure of the winery companies. All right.
So they're probably scamming and doing another deal using the winery overinflated value.
Right. I'm sitting there going, well, because I had gone through and I had identified about in the short period of time that they owned it at that point between February of 2013 and August of 2013, I had identified about $1.2 million worth of funds that Southport had slushed through the winery. And I'm keep going, what is this? What was this for? What was that for? $250,000 came in one day, it goes out the side door the next day. You know, I mean, tell me what this was about. And so with the preferred stock, they told me that that was going to be the amount of money that they've put in post-transaction, post-acquiring the company, so that $1.2 million, and that it's a preferred stock in the name of one of the, of Redwood Insurance, which is one of their insurance companies, and sign it and send it back. And I'm like, you know. So I called Jeff. I go, Jeff, what's this? And he goes, yeah, it's just the way they're going to paper it because, you know, there's so much money that's, you know, there's no paper trail behind it. And these guys were absolutely horrid at paper trails. And that's one of the things, that was one of the things that first got me, you know, just another thing that got me suspicious is they had, you know, two lawyers working there, and the paper trail was non-existent on so many transactions. So I reluctantly sent them because, okay, for $1.2 million, I've identified the $1.2 million. They're going to the insurance company, which is where the money purportedly came from, the $1.2 million. Okay, so we'll do this. We're just going to have to paper it right, you know, the next time I go see these guys. So I did.
You were an officer of the company by this point.
I'm the issuer of the securities.
Wow.
Wow. Okay.
So you are taking responsibility now.
I am totally on the line. The minute I signed that stock certificate. So we sit there, we do that. I send it back to him. And, you know, and as I say in the book, you know, it was a Friday. Took my wife down to some restaurant, a restaurant that we love on the harbor here in the town we live in. I'm sitting there. I've got a martini in my front in front of me. I would say to myself, I just made a big mistake doing that. There's just too many unanswered questions. I shouldn't have done it, but you know, I was pressured, and you know, at that point, I'm starting to get angry.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about ultimately how the company fell. How did it eventually get all of this exposed and lead to the downfall?
Because it's a house of cards.
Right.
It's a total house of cards. It's a total house of cards. All of a sudden, people wanted to start making good on the securities that they had printed up, you know, a year earlier, 2 years earlier. The hold periods were coming off.
That includes stock certificates in the company that you're now running and trying to improve
Correct.
The value and make profitable.
Correct. All right. But that was in the name of an insurance company, and they were the majority owners of the insurance company. So I felt somehow that that was a little bit of a protection. There was no litigation involved there. But the sellers of the other insurance companies were, where's our money? And so the other insurance companies were starting to get, the sellers of the insurance companies were starting to get hostile. And I was literally sitting in the conference room at Southport Lane with Alex Burns, and he's completely, you know, I'm sitting there giving him an update on the vineyard. This is January of 2014. And I'm giving him an update in the vineyard, and I'm sitting there going, listen, you want to do this? This is going to require another $250,000 investment. It's got to be done by this time. We can parcel it out over these period of months, and I'll make the cash flow, because winter in a vineyard in Long Island, New York, the business is pretty much gone. There's no retail business.
Right. So, what are you doing during that time?
Yeah, you're trying to survive. It's a seasonal business. And so, you know, I'm sitting there, and I can't get his attention. He's just staring into his phone. And, you know, excuse the language, and he looks down, he's looking at his phone, and he goes, oh, fuck, oh, fuck, oh, fuck. You know, at that point, he was the age of one of my kids, you know, he felt like he was the age of three kids. And he sits there, and I go, you okay? What's the matter? He goes, I hate my insurance companies. And next thing, he got up, walked out of the conference room, went to the elevators, got in the elevators, went down. Nobody saw him again.
Those were the last words he said to you?
That's it.
And he just disappeared after that.
Checked himself into Bellevue Psychiatric Ward, telling people he had a nervous breakdown.
House of Cards was falling. I would too. Yeah.
It's falling right on him, and he knows he can't finagle his way out of it. He can't deal his way out of it. He can't BS his way out of it. All right.
Wow. Yep. I'm having a nervous breakdown just hearing the story and imagining, what do you even do when the game's up?
Well, he checked into Bellevue for a day. He told his girlfriend that he was in there. He's having a nervous breakdown. He apparently signed a separation agreement within the next couple of days from Southport, the essence of which was, I'll give you all the stock in Southport that my ownership position, which at that point was like 80%, if you don't sue me. And he took responsibility for some of the, you know, oddball transactions that were going on, and left some sort of affidavit. I don't know. I've never seen it. But in that separation document, it lists yours truly, Richard D. Bailey, as the person who is going to collect all of Alex's personal possessions out of the 8,000 square foot vineyard house.
Because he was kind of using the vineyard house as a weekend getaway.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, and so, you know, I did that, and I had to clean everything out, and his Porsche with the license plates reinsure. You know,
oh, wow.
Okay, for Porsche enthusiasts out there, it was an automatic Porsche. It wasn't a stick shift. There's something fundamentally wrong about that. But anyway,
was it an SUV?
It was a 911. But, you know, so he just left. He just disappeared. And
so he resigns from the company, but he's the founder of the company.
Right. So all of a sudden, Andrew Scheer, his partner, a minority partner, suddenly owns everything.
And including the troubles, the legal troubles.
All of them. His hands weren't exactly clean. And, you know, as we're recording this, he is, you know, still in prison. But there was, at that point, everything just came to an absolute halt. But right around that time, see, I had already started digging in, because earlier in another meeting, Burns told a friend of mine, not affiliated with the Southport Lane, although Jeff Leach and I were in the meeting, we talk about this occasionally. You know, my friend, who is a true private equity person, one of the smartest people and most ethical people I've ever met, sits there and says, Alex, how'd you get control of all these insurance companies? And Alex turns around and this is one of those never forget moments, spins around on its heel, Cheshire Cat grin, stares at us and says, "Jesus with a telescope on Mars can figure out how I did this."
Wow. Arrogant a bit much?
Yeah, seriously.
Right. And, but for me, that's like waving the red flag in front of the bull. I got to find out. I got to.
Right.
Now I've got the needle in my arm. I've got to figure this out.
You took it as a personal dare.
Oh, without question. Without question. Did I ever buy a BS9 like that? Without question.
Wow. So he resigned. His partner's kind of left holding the bag. What happened to Burns's personal and professional life? How is he affected if he's completely separated from the company? Did he just go off into the sunset?
He went to a month of rehab at a very posh, shishi place in Connecticut. He is from Connecticut. He was raised in Westport, Connecticut. And then the next we hear of him, he has moved to Charleston, South Carolina, where he's starting it all over again.
Huh.
Talked to some of the people in Charleston, South Carolina that he knew. I said, "How did you meet him?" So I met him in a card game. I said, "Now, at this point, Alex is probably 27, 28 years old." And we asked him what he did, and he said he was a retired hedge fund manager.
Mm-hmm.
Retired.
That's it. You know, so
it's the wrong description. I think he meant trust fund.
Yeah. Well, he didn't have one of those either, I can tell you. So he just started in all over again down there. He opened up a distillery. He started getting involved in real estate transactions down there. And he was at it for about a year and a half down there. And then the Wall Street Journal articles came out in, let me see, that would be 2015, February of 2015.
And I know you've been at the winery for a couple of years. Are you just going to work every day doing your job?
No. Well, A, yes. B, in order to keep the place alive, because remember, Southport was foolish enough to buy the entire place for cash. There was no debt on the balance sheet. And we still had about, you know, $5.5 million worth of AAA assets. So I borrowed $2 million against them, keep the place alive and to, you know, kind of do a little bit of a revamp of the company and personally guaranteed it, which I never told my wife for quite some time.
Oh, you personally guaranteed it?
Oh, yeah.
Wow. But you must have had some faith that you would be able to improve the performance of the company.
At that point, I knew where we had to go.
Okay.
But there was still a risk that regulators could come in and seize the assets of the insurance companies. And wouldn't that include Lee Vineyards?
It would, yes. But that's when I went through a private detective by the name of Bo Deedle in New York, who I was introduced to by a friend, by a mutual friend. And they're the ones who confirmed to me that a federal crime had occurred. And they hooked me up with, interesting side note of those guys, they called the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, who at the time was Preet Bharara. They called his office and said, "We have something we want to refer into you guys." And Preet Bharara's office waved them off, said, "Not interested." All right.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So then we went to and we hooked up with a guy who became one of, you know, my closest advisor and is still one of my close friend, Michael Weinstein, from a firm in New Jersey called Cole Shots. And Michael was a former AUSA out of D.C. It was Michael that got us in front. We were trying to get to the FBI. We didn't know. We were trying to get to some law enforcement. You know, one of the things I wanted to find out was, you know, I had Bo Deedle's firm run background checks on people. And I just said, you know, if law enforcement's involved, who is it and can we get to them? Because now I've got first-party information.
Right.
And statements.
Right.
I can trace the flow of money.
And you understand it, which I think is another key component. Sometimes law enforcement, they don't have a financial background necessarily.
No. So anyway, we were sitting there and you're right. And we were sitting there and finally, you know, after about, I don't know, Weinstein, Michael is representing me for about 2 weeks. And I'm sitting there about to get on the ferry to come home. I was in Orient Point, New York, and Michael was a very calm, measured person. You know, when he talks to you, it's everything's thought out. You know, I mean, he's just a solid first-class criminal defense attorney. And the phone rings, and Michael just starts, "Are you sitting down? oh my God, I just spoke to the town. There's a whole task force in Washington going, oh, this is the SEC, the FBI, the CFTC. They're all involved in this. I just spoke to the, I mean, he's just, you know, motor mouth, and which is completely out of character. He goes, I just spoke to the lead agent from the FBI, and they want to know if, you know, they want to meet you. And I'm like, well, yeah, great. That's what we've been trying to get to. And that's when he said, but they have one more question. I'm like, what's that? You know, they want to know if you'll wear a wire.
Well, that'll get your heart pumping.
Yeah, that's exciting, I guess.
Never saw that question coming.
No.
And so I asked for the weekend to think it over and came home. Finally told my wife everything that was going on.
Your wife didn't know about this?
Not a lot of it, no.
Whoa.
No need to.
It's her reaction.
Typical my wife's reaction. She looked at me and she says, she's a very, very smart woman who knows me very, very well. And she said, I can see you've already made up your mind. She was right. I had. I was going to do it. And she said, I just ask that you be careful. And I said, I will. And I had no idea what I was getting myself into.
So what was the ultimate result of this investigation?
Well, 4 indictments, 4 guilty pleas. And pretty much they all pled guilty. You know, in plea deals, you know, information pleas. And so there were 4 plea deals. One guy went to prison for the Caravaggio transaction.
There you go.
About $1 million. Seems he got $1 million commission and never declared it to account his taxes.
Oh.
There's the tax crime right there.
And then, oh, yeah. And, you know, and I got to tell you something. The IRS Criminal Investigative Division guy who was part of the task force and was a good guy. I just had a conversation with him a couple weeks ago. He was sitting there and he was just sitting there going, I'm going to get these guys. He goes, somebody didn't pay taxes.
Of course.
Right.
You've got to pay taxes on the commission on a phony counterfeit artwork.
Right.
Well, exactly. I mean, the funny thing is, if he had paid the taxes, what would he have done wrong? He could have been in a representation issue, a fraudulent representation issue on the validity or on the provenance of the Caravaggio. But, you know, he didn't rep to that in any of the documents.
Right.
You know, so
he's the taxes that get you in the end.
Yeah. So he was sentenced to 18 months, but he was released after about 6 during COVID. And Rob McGraw, who was a nice guy, a good kid, he's the one who made the representation that the $50 million worth of fake securities were good. Rob was a brilliant guy, went to NYU. He had a master's degree in taxation, you know, and he just a brilliant kid who just didn't know how to say no to these guys, you know.
Yeah.
So he was sentenced to 18 months, did about 10. And Andrew Scheer, who is the one who inherited the empire when Burns, you know, left, was sentenced to 60 months and he'll get out in April 24 after about that, which will be about 2.5 years.
And wow.
Of course, Alex Burns was a cooperating witness for several years. With the FBI. And now I didn't know this at the time. I found out afterwards. And when the FBI was basically done with that, as long as Burns had not been indicted, Burns was actually indicted in 2019, I think, or 2016. I forget the exact date, but he was indicted, but it was under seal in the Southern District of New York.
So no one knew.
So no one knew. All right. And so he served as a corroborating witness throughout that entire time until 2021, so basically 5 years, during which time he was pulling all sorts of crazy stuff in Charleston, South Carolina.
So scamming, and I'm assuming he got an immunity deal. He's already been charged, but nobody knows it because it's under seal. I'm sure he did so based on immunity, and he's scamming at the same time.
Yeah, I don't know if he got an immunity deal. My theory is because he was scheduled to be sentenced in, I think it was December 19th of 2021, he committed suicide at the end of October 2021. My suspicion is, now, you know, Alex had, you know, Asperger's and a few other things, and, you know, he was obviously not a stable person. My suspicion is that he was given, according to the coroner's report, which I have, he committed suicide after receiving significant negative legal news. I suspect that negative legal news was he got the Justice Department's pre-sentencing memorandum.
Oh.
So he was looking at significant prison time.
Well, yeah. if you, you know, go to the sentencing guidelines, you know, you would have been in life.
Right.
Because of the amount. Yeah. Talking three, by this time, it's $350 million.
Quite an accomplishment for a 28-year-old.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, that's always been my suspicion of what caused him to commit suicide, because the timing is just about right.
Right. Wow. What a sad ending to.
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, you know, even some of the guys, you know, Jeff Leach and some of the other guys who worked at Southport, you know, we were all sad to hear that he did that. This sounds weird. He was kind of likable in a certain way. I mean, you know, there was nothing. Yeah, he could be an obnoxious, arrogant little twerp, but, you know, there was nothing mean or vindictive about him.
Right.
He was just looking to be liked and to be one of the boys. He's just looking for people to be in awe of him. You know, he was just such an insecure human being that, you know, he did, and this is my theory, I'm not a psychologist, but he did all these things because he wanted people to be impressed by him.
And he received some of that, right? I mean, it's not every day that people are able to pull off these types of schemes. And a lot of times the schemes are successful only because you're so likable.
Yeah.
That it causes people to ignore the red flags is what we noticed.
And he even started a second scheme down in South Carolina, right? So when the first one fell apart, he was already on to number two and was making progress on number two.
Right.
Right. And what the folks in South Carolina told me is that when the Wall Street Journal articles came out, they were front page of the journal, weekend section, but, you know, everything started to close in and started to, you know, kind of, you know, constrict in his life, you know. And when people like that, you know, they relish, they thrive on being able to grab a private jet and let's go to a, you know, a football game at LSU or something like that. You know, suddenly his life started getting smaller and smaller and smaller. To the point where he actually flim-flammed his fiance, and that's a separate story, but it's equally as sad.
Right. Yeah, I think the discovery is such a betrayal. I mean, even on behalf of his employees, and I imagine even his partner who was in the know, it would still be, I imagine, a shock to be left holding the bag. I'm sure he probably didn't expect his partner to take off like that.
Right.
And that sense of betrayal has got to be intense.
Well, yeah. I mean, because you have to think about the psyche of people who would do this. And I've seen lots of people pull off frauds and things that were shady over the course of 35 years dealing with companies that were in trouble. They're in trouble for a reason. Sometimes they're in trouble because people were doing shady things back there. The psyche of these folks is always, no one will know.
Right.
Right.
They always thought they were smarter than the rules. They always thought nobody would ever find out. Nobody will know. Nobody cares. No one will know.
It almost happened. You tried to blow the whistle and they didn't care.
Yeah. When I asked them, what are all these, you know, funky, you know, cash transactions? You know, that's when all of a sudden they changed the subject and they, I call it, you know, praise and a raise. You know, they sat there and sung my praises on the work I had done in the vineyard and, you know, offered me, you know, additional responsibility with other portfolio companies at Southport.
Right.
And
look over here. Look over there.
I know. Yeah. And you want to know something? Shame on me. I fell for it.
Right. But it's that likability that comes into the equation because you've formed relationships with the people behind this by that time.
And oh, yeah.
That's sort of our downfall when we're able to be able to be taken advantage of in that respect.
Yep. It's a tragic tale. It really is. It's going to happen again. I mean, it just happened with Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX. Very similar.
Savant, albeit he doesn't look like Jimmy Neutron this time, right? He does have a unique look.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny because it's always been kind of bothering me. What is it about these august individuals, people of purpose and noteworthiness and big, you know, impressive investment managers? Why do they always get themselves involved in investing with these people, especially young folks?
Right.
Who are promising Elizabeth Holmes at Theranos.
Yeah.
Promising something that nobody else has ever done. You know,
right.
And it's amazing because I watched Burns do this.
Right. Yes, I've noticed the same pattern. And to me, and probably to you as well, Richard, as a certified fraud examiner, that sets off alarm bell. Young, lack of experience, and even if you've got an education, there's a lot of your know-how that comes from on-the-job training and experience and seeing different situations that we know can't possibly be present in a 24-year-old or a 19-year-old in Elizabeth Holmes' case.
So it's normal to have a lot of skepticism about the so-called product, right? And instead of seeing skepticism, we see people embrace it, run towards it, and then be shocked when it all falls apart.
Yeah. You know, wait a minute. We was robbed, you know? I mean, but they didn't put the facts together in such a way that you sit there and just say, well, wait a minute, what's wrong here? I mean, with the FTX thing, you know, why didn't anybody, like, you know, Anthony Scaramucci from Skybridge Capital, what's his name, O'Leary from Shark Tank and MLS, they put money in. Why didn't anybody sit there and say to one of their lawyers, which they have dozens on their staff that they can call in, go check these people out and see what's going on? I mean, you're talking about an FTX where they were approving nine-figure transactions with an emoji.
Yep.
They need a Bo Deedle in their life, it sounds like. Yeah. Check these things out.
Listen, this has been a great interview. And when Pirate Cove is made into a movie, it is going to be one of those movies that stands right alongside American Hustle, The Wolf of Wall Street. It's going to go down with all of those suspenseful, exciting, white-collar crime stories. And I don't know who's going to play me and play you, Tom, as the podcasters in that movie. Time will tell. If you'd like to get your hands on a copy of that book, go on over to Amazon.com. You're going to type in Pirate Cove. Richard D. Bailey is the author. Richard, thank you again for being with us today, and best of luck in your book sales and your success as an author.
This has been a very exciting conversation. We'll have to have you back on the show at some point to talk about some other cases. It's just been a pleasure.
Yes, thank you so much. I've learned so much, and it was great talking to you.
Thank you, and thank you very much for the opportunity to, you know, share the story. Yeah, I would look forward to talking to you guys again. That'd be great.
Thanks for listening to Tax Crime Junkies. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Don't forget to rate and review us. Stay on top of what's happening with the podcast by following us on Instagram and X at Tax Crime Junkies, or visit taxcrimejunkies.com.